The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you think of luxury items, maybe you think of products like jewelry or cosmetics or cologne. These items are often subject to luxury sales tax because they're not considered necessities. In most states, tampons and pads are also taxed because they are not necessities either. Really? Surprised? Well, you're not alone. In January of this year, 24-year-old YouTube star Ingrid Nilsson posed this question to President Obama during an interview.
And recently, I was shocked to learn that pads, tampons, and other menstrual products are taxed as luxury goods in 40 states. Yeah. And so I want to know, why do these items continue to be taxed?
I have to tell you, I have no idea why states would tax these as luxury items. I suspect it's because men were making the laws when those taxes were passed.
So, caring for oneself during the essential, recurring female experience of menstruation is considered a luxury. It is also taboo, even shameful to talk about. But that is beginning to change. Abigail Jones is senior writer at Newsweek, where we found her cover story, "The Fight to End Period Shaming is Going Mainstream." And Abigail, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
I was also shocked, like Ingrid, to hear that pads and tampons are now taxed in 40 states. Which states are working to get rid of this tax?
So New York State is one of the leaders in getting rid of the tampon tax. It has some of the most comprehensive legislation. It's not just about eliminating the tax on tampons and pads, but New York also wants to put free tampons and pads in all public schools, homeless shelters, and prisons. The other thing I would say is that, you know, 40 states, that's a lot. It's the majority of states in the country that right now tax pads and tampons. But in the past year, 14 states have brought legislation forward, plus three cities. And that's actually a lot of change in a short amount of time.
So is this a political issue?
It's a political issue. It is more than that, though. I mean, I would argue that menstruation is one of the most ignored human rights issues around the world. It affects education, the economy, the environment, public health, and periods have been shunned and silenced. And that's for, you know, those of you listening, it's for your daughters, it's for, you know, your teenagers, but it's also for adult women in workplaces, it's for homeless women and the challenges that girls and women face all around the world. But the good news is there are advocates who are working very hard to eliminate the tampon tax. There are swelling social movements. There are finally innovations in menstrual products and organizations working to reach people in developing countries. So this change in the last 12 months, really, 14 out of 40 states bringing forward legislation to get rid of the tampon tax, that is one example among many about how this is finally starting to change.
So what's the argument for keeping the tax?
It varies. In California, for example, there's a bill that was introduced in January to exempt women's menstrual products from sales taxes. Now, if this bill passes, people in California will have $20 million back in their wallets. And if you think about just $20 million, that's a lot of money. But as Assemblymember Christina Garcia, who's one of the people behind this bill, points out, $20 million is the equivalent of just 0.01% of California's state budget. And so you can see how people can argue both sides. $20 million, that's so much money. Actually, it's not. It's just 0.01% of the budget. But it is still a significant amount of money to put back in people's wallets. And I'm saying people knowingly because it's not just women who go out to buy pads and tampons. Partners, men, they do that as well. But that is money that would then be funneled back into the economy in other ways. And just to take a moment to speak to the pushback, you know, you said, well, what's the argument for not passing it? Assemblymember Garcia said that when she first started working on this issue, she was made fun of by her colleagues. They called her Miss Flo. Mm-hmm. They called her Miss Maxie. And these are fellow elected officials. Now, she also points out that over time, she got a lot of these people on her side. She now has over 30 co-authors on this bill. But this is a bill that she even says to this day, she can't use the word blood. She can't use the word blood to talk about menstruation. And I said to her, well, what do you call it? And she said, you know, I call it that stuff that's not a blue liquid. Or I remind them that, you know it's not a blue liquid, right?
You mean like the blue liquid that's poured on the pads in commercials to show how absorbent they are?
Yes, the sanitizing of what menstruation actually is, according to commercials.
Well, of course, we can see some double standards here, you know, toilet paper, soap, you know, those are not taxed. They're not considered anything other than necessities. And also condoms, they're given away free in many places, whereas menstrual products are not only expensive, they're taxed. So they take a lot out of the family budget, and you can't even buy them apparently with SNAP benefits or, you know, what we used to call food stamp benefits. Is that true?
That's true. And what's so upsetting to me about that fact is, you know, periods are a fact of life. The vast majority of girls and women have periods. It's not a luxury. It's not a choice. It's a natural fact of being a woman. And if you consider what's not taxed, right? In Washington, Christmas tree production is not taxed. Donuts in Michigan. Coffins in Mississippi. Bagged salads in Colorado, and gun club memberships in Wisconsin. I could go on and on. These items are not taxed, but items that every girl and woman who has a period needs to be able to get through her day, they're taxed in 40 states. That's upsetting.
Abigail Jones is with us. She's senior writer at Newsweek and author of the cover story about the fight to end period shaming. We were just talking about the tax on tampons and feminine products in many states where they are not considered to be necessities. Well, Abigail looked into the history of those policies and the products and the attitudes about a very normal part of the life of girls and women of childbearing age. Let me just jump into the history here. 1920 is when Kotex first came out with sanitary pads on the market. The tampon, invented by a man, by the way, in 1931. But in the mid-70s, another breakthrough proclaimed in tampon design, Procter & Gamble released a product called Rely. Let's just listen to an ad when it first came on the market.
Rely is a whole new kind of tampon. So it's a real improvement in feminine protection.
It's really different and better. Look for the magazine ads. They'll tell you all about Rely.
Rely's worth finding out about. After all, it's really a better tampon. Remember, they named it Rely.
Well, that must mean it's better. This commercial is so vague. And I want to get to this kind of idea of innovation or lack thereof inside of this market. What supposedly made Rely a different and better product?
So in 1975, Procter & Gamble began test marketing Rely tampons. They were tea bag shaped, and they were part of a group of tampons called super absorbents. They were made of synthetic materials, and they had a key ingredient that boosted absorption, allegedly so much so that the tampon could theoretically last for a woman's entire period. And I spoke with a couple historians on menstruation and experts who all said to me that they had spoken to people anecdotally who had used Rely tampons in the late 70s, who some of them thought they were fantastic. They enabled them to get through their day in a way that they never had before. Others found Rely tampons very painful to use, painful to insert and to remove. What I think, you know, if you know anything about the history of tampons, you know that there was the toxic shock syndrome crisis of the late 70s and 1980. What happened is that in 1980, 890 cases of toxic shock syndrome were reported to the CDC, and 91% of those were directly related to menstruation. 38 women died, and at the time, think about this, at the time of the TSS crisis, 70% of American women were using tampons. And even though Rely tampons had just about a quarter of the market, they were responsible for 75% of TSS cases. So this TSS crisis kind of came barging into the homes of American families. And so, I don't know, you just imagine being a young girl or a mom or a woman using these products, and suddenly this is plastered all over the news, and how that would shake you, your sense of safety, and how do you believe what companies are selling you on? I mean, you know, we just listen to the ad. The ad says it even absorbs the worry.
Well, now consumers are really keyed into ingredients, what things are made of, you know, gluten in their diets, BPA or PFOA on our cooking pans. But tampons, I understand, are unregulated. Is that so by the FDA?
That's correct. The FDA does not require companies to disclose the ingredients in tampons and pads, which...
What's the rationale there? I mean,
it's a good question. And I have to say, I interviewed, I don't know, probably over 24 experts. And then I spoke to many, many women of all different ages for this story. The majority of those women, when I said, what's in your tampon? What is it made out of? They either looked at me in a puzzled way or they said cotton. But no, commercial tampons are actually made of some combination of rayon, cotton, and synthetic fibers. And the details of that, we don't actually know. I mean, go to your local pharmacy, pick up a box of tampons, and I challenge you, try to find somewhere among all of that tiny fine print a list of ingredients. Hmm. And in reaction, one of the positive things that's happening right now is that we're getting a whole host of new startups and companies that are putting on the market tampons that are either made of 100% natural cotton or are just organic cotton.
Abigail, I remember reading about this, and you mention it in your article, this satirical hypothesis that Gloria Steinem wrote about in Ms. in, I guess it was late 70s. If men suddenly began menstruating, it would become an enviable, boastworthy, masculine event. And 40 years later, you know, I'm talking with you about this. I clearly am sure a listener can tell from my voice, am wondering, huh? Seriously? Is this still going on? I can hear it in your voice as well. And we even wondered if people would write us and say they're offended by us talking about this on the air. Is it really changing?
I think it is changing. And I think that satire from Gloria Steinem hits the nail on the head. I do think we have evidence of change, and I think it's actually better than that. There's evidence of a movement, which is what my article sought to explain. It's not just a list of successes. It's not just, oh, here are a few examples of states where the tampon tax might change. We have sweeping change in the policy arena. On top of that, we have sweeping awareness that is going on about lack of regulation, lack of knowledge about what women are putting into their bodies. I can't tell you how many women said to me, oh my God, I do all this research. I know where my food comes from. I know what goes into my food. I know where my clothes come from. I know what diapers I choose to buy for my baby. But I never thought about what went into a tampon, which I put in one of the most absorbent parts of my body every month for 30 to 40 years. And so I think that spreading awareness is important. It also comes down to everyday people. I interviewed a mom who told me that when her daughter got her period very recently, she was one of the first girls in her group of friends to get her period. She had just gone to the middle school. I think she started sixth grade. She only had 2 minutes in between classes. And if she had to use the bathroom, she not only had to go to another floor, but if she didn't have a pad or tampon, she had to walk all the way to the nurse's office. So this mom went to the school, and she did something about it. Now that school offers free pads and tampons in every bathroom. She also got the high school to do the same thing. So this isn't just something that is up to politicians. It's up to all of us. It's how we talk to our daughters about what periods are. It's about how we talk to our sons about what periods are. How do boys react to that moment when someone reaches into their backpack to grab out an iPhone and accidentally a tampon flies across the room? That happened to me in my math class when I was in middle school, and it was mortifying. But if boys and girls would react in a supportive way, it would just be a normal fact of life.
Abigail Jones, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Abigail Jones, she's senior writer for Newsweek. You'll find a link to her cover story, The Fight to End Period Shaming is Going Mainstream, for Newsweek, and more of her work. That's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Objects are all around us, from the chair or car you're sitting in to whichever device you're hearing my voice on right now. Most of us are accustomed to directly engaging with objects, and they provoke feeling. Whether smiling as you swipe through photos on your phone or yelling at Siri more and more loudly to get your voice command right. What we are unused to are objects that teach us how to interact with each other. Roman Mars and Benjamin Walker from the podcast 99% Invisible explore how design can help.
In the world of Philip K. Dick, humans are often at the mercy of objects like taxis, coffee makers, and doors. Here's a scene from his book, Ubik.
The door refused to open. It said, 5 cents, please. Joe Chip searched his pockets. No more coins, nothing. I'll pay you tomorrow, he told the door. Again, he tried the knob. Again, it remained locked tight. From the drawer besides the sink, Joe got a stainless steel knife. With it, he began systematically to unscrew the bolt assembly of his money-gulping door. I'll sue you, the door said, as the first screw fell out.
That's Benjamin Walker. He told me he's always subscribed to Dick's dystopian vision of man versus object. But then he met up with Paola Antonelli.
Philip K. Dick's view of the future of objects was definitely dystopian, and he needed it for like drama reasons. But in truth, we've had a rapport with objects throughout the centuries. I mean, there's always been affection, emotion, heirloom ring, or the bridge where you had your first kiss. I mean, there's always been an attachment. There's a whole universe in every single object that becomes even bigger when put in relationship with a person.
Paola Antonelli is a senior curator in the Department of Architecture and Design at the Museum of Modern Art. Her most recent blockbuster show, Talk to Me, examined the future and the history of communication design.
Furniture design or car design is just one fragment of the design world. And for many years, there's been something called communication design, which maybe before used to be called graphic design, which is the design of messages, be it advertising or be it just signage. So it's existed. So that's design whose subject is communication. But right now, the difference is that even furniture designers need to understand that a chair might need to have some kind of conversation with people.
There was a talking chair in her show.
This is the era in which chairs can talk. If they can talk, they can sing.
And talking toys and talking maps. But there were also ATMs and subway kiosks. According to Paola Antonelli, cutting-edge communication design is all about the interface.
When you say interface, you can take out the face and put section. You can take out section and put relation. I mean, it's one of the focal points of the way we live today and the way culture moves today.
Paola Antonelli says designers understand the interface between people and objects better than, say, science fiction writers, because what they're really working on is the interface between people and people. One of the pieces she put in her show was a menstruation machine.
And in that particular case, the interface is not between man and machine, it's between man and woman, right? So it's a contraption that looks like a chastity belt that it's for men, but also for menopausal women. And it really gives you the feeling of a menstruation. It has electrodes that stimulate your lower abdomen and they give you cramps. And then it has a reservoir in the back. You're supposed to draw your blood, put it in there, and then you have your blood drip exactly where it should. So It's the whole shebang. And to me, it's the ultimate gesture of understanding. And that's what I really love, that interface, not the human-machine interface. The human-machine interface, you know what? We are all doing, engineers, designers, scientists, we're all trying to make technology disappear. That's the truth. Just like we go through the toll booths in freeways using Easy Pass, and we still have that box, but we don't think about it. That's how life should be, so that we can focus on real human habits and human needs as opposed to focusing on the technology.
And that piece was produced by Roman Mars and Benjamin Walker from the podcast 99% Invisible.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Expectant mothers are under a lot of pressure. They're supposed to exercise, but not too much. They need to eat for two, but some foods are discouraged and others off limits entirely. Then there are the birthing classes and the right baby stuff to get and the anxieties about health and delivery, never mind the actual delivery. Motherhood may be enormously fulfilling, but preparing for it is not always easy. One population of soon-to-be moms faces another set of challenges. This story comes to us from Sam Evans-Brown from NHPR's new show, Outside In.
So, being the parent of a child who wants to be an extreme athlete, one who's full of ambition and totally devoid of fear, that's got one set of challenges. But how about being an elite athlete who wants to be a parent?
It's the type of thing where there's not a lot of scientific research right now to back it up because you can't really experiment on women that are pregnant. And then the number of elite athletes that are doing it is quite small.
This is Keegan Randall. If you haven't heard of her, I forgive you. Actually, no, I don't. This is Keegan Randall.
And look at the globe in the hand of the sprint champion, Keegan Randall of the United States.
Ingsmar's daughter trying to close on Keegan Randall.
Keegan Randall has been building to this part of her career for over a decade. Her first Olympic Games was in 2002 as just a teenager.
Keegan Randall was the first American woman to win a medal at a cross-country skiing world championships ever. And I will admit to being something of a Nordic skiing fanboy here, so, you know. And Keegan is basically like the peekaboo street of Nordic skiing. Everyone who's into the sport knows who she is. She's this charismatic ambassador for the sport, and she's a total badass. She's got this awesome nickname, Keekanimal. But this year, she didn't race, because instead, she was busy having a son. I got to talk to her in Wisconsin back in February when she was 7 months along.
You're taking a year off, but you're still, like, training hardcore while pregnant.
Yeah.
Which, you know, as a dude, I guess I don't know what's really involved with that, but what's it like?
Well, it's been a really interesting experience. It's something that I knew I'd for a few years that I was wanting to do. So I tried to kind of read about other elite athletes who had maybe gone through training while pregnant. And I read about some runners, but cross-country skiing was kind of this new realm because there had been some that had done it, but they hadn't really published their stories anywhere. So it was a little bit of an exploration.
And are there things that you're like, they're like, oh, this just doesn't work? Like, does it mess with your skate technique kind of thing?
I haven't noticed too much of a change in my technique. The downhill's a little harder to get into a tuck. But otherwise, skiing has been a great activity. You know, it's low impact. So skiing has really felt great. Running has felt a little funny at times. In the weight room, I've been surprised with how much I've been able to do. I do notice when I do go up to the higher intensities a little bit, you definitely breathe in a little harder. And your body just tells you you don't really need to go there right now.
We're in the middle of a bit of a shift when it comes to what's considered to be a healthy amount of physical activity for women to do during pregnancy. Doctors are saying that you can keep doing a lot of the things that you did before you were pregnant pretty far into term. But culturally, we're not quite caught up to the latest scientific understanding yet. There's this CrossFit athlete named Emily Breeze, who's been attracting some media attention for keeping at her CrossFit workouts while she's pregnant. She posted a video of herself to Instagram deadlifting a 180-pound weight while 34 weeks pregnant. For the record, she deadlifts 325 pounds when she's not expecting. All you have to do is scroll through some of the comments on her feed to know that there are a lot of people out there who have appointed themselves experts on other people's pregnancies.
Obviously, you don't care much about your baby. If you keep putting yourself at risk, anything can happen, and this isn't okay.
Oh my God, she scares me. Wonder how the baby is.
Shaking my head.
Well, yeah, women get shamed on the internet all the time for almost anything that they do. And I don't think pregnancy is any different from that.
This is Nancy.
My name is Nancy Hogshead Maycar.
She wrote the guidelines that NCAA schools are supposed to follow on how to not discriminate against pregnant student athletes. And she knows a thing or two about being an athlete.
Yes. In 1984, I won 3 gold medals and 1 silver medal in swimming.
And about being pregnant and being an athlete.
And I swam through my first pregnancy in particular. And my belly got in the way of, like, I couldn't do a flip turn. And I think I got out of the water at 10 p.m. and I delivered at 5 a.m. that day.
The NCAA came to Nancy for help after an ESPN documentary showed that a number of college women who were afraid of losing their spot on the team or their scholarships had felt pressure to have an abortion. And this part is horrible, but 2 student athletes even hid their pregnancies all the way to term and then killed their newborn children.
The typical experience that I find of a pregnant athlete is that they sort of slink away and they don't really know what their rights are. They have a right to be pregnant. They have a right to an abortion if they want to. They have a right to have time off to recover from that pregnancy. And they have the right to be reinstated to the position of the team that they were beforehand.
And this brings us to some pregnancy myths that Nancy has been trying to dispel. First, that exercising while pregnant is bad for the baby.
The miscarriage rates for pregnancy remain the same. They're pretty stable regardless of how much exercise somebody does. So, you know, when, you know, I've got 10-year-old twins and I've got a 15-year-old son, and I was told, you know, you got to make sure your body temperature doesn't get up and that you don't, you know, let your heart rate get over a certain percentage. And all those restrictions now, medical science says, just don't apply.
Seems like we're sort of trapped in this Victorian era medical thinking.
Yeah, yeah, it's so true. Yeah.
You mentioned that men and their partners have children at much higher rates. What is the difference between men and women?
So the pregnancy rate for women of college age is about 11% a year. There are football teams out there with parenting rates of over 60%.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it has to do with the shame that we put on female athletes that become pregnant. Typically, they're not married. Typically, they don't have a job. Well, they're not allowed to have a job while they're participating in sports. But, you know, they're in the middle of their education. It's typically unplanned. The shame that's involved with getting pregnant keeps them from being able to be advocates for themselves.
So I think culturally, a lot of people assume it's kind of obvious to ask to a female athlete, will you keep competing once you're a mother? Whereas if a man decides to become a father, the presumption is almost the opposite. You know, of course you'll keep competing even if you have a child. What, I mean, do we have an easy explanation for why that is?
Other than blatant sexism? I mean, the double standard that we hold men and women to.
There are legal protections for women on national teams and those working for teams in a professional league, say the WNBA. But for a lot of athletes outside of the big money-making sports, it's not the team that pays the bills, it's sponsors. Here's Keegan Randall again out in Wisconsin, where she was, yes, signing autographs and doing an appearance for a sponsor.
I mean, if you choose to have a baby and you're not racing, you're no guaranteed to keep your sponsors. You're not guaranteed to keep your spot on the team. And when you do come back to racing, you know, you do have to work your way back from the bottom. I mean, there's a lot of unknowns. And so I think we can do a better job as sports organizations, and whether that's national or international, to really help support our female athletes. Because men that have families, you know, it's great, and they certainly face challenges, but they don't have to stop racing. They don't have to turn down the sponsor contracts and things like that. And I really think it's beneficial for our sports to keep some of our top athletes competing and not having to choose about sport or family.
Keegan and her husband Jeff welcomed their little baby boy, Breck, into the world on April 15th. He was 8 pounds, 11 ounces, and 21 inches. They brought him out for his first hike, 10 days later.
That was Sam Evans Brown, host of Outside In, NHBR's new show about the natural world and how we use it. There's a whole new episode about parenting in the outdoors coming up tomorrow at 3. You can learn more at outsideinradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHBR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time again for the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. That's the podcast where I ask writers about how they work. Kill him and leave was James Brown's commandment to his band before every show. It's also the title of a biography of the soul legend by author James McBride. The National Book Award winner is also a musician and a composer. And we sat down with James McBride just before his appearance at the Writers in the Loft series at the Music Hall Loft in Portsmouth. Here he is, taking it to the bridge.
This is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop with James McBride.
Which do you think is harder to write? Is it the first sentence or the last?
The first sentence by a lot, because you're framing the story as soon as your pen hits the page, so you better aim your gun in the right direction. Pardon the bad metaphor, but you better be shooting straight. Otherwise, your characters will run away with you.
But do you edit as you go and rewrite that sentence, or do you wait until the end?
I rewrite everything, and I rewrite it usually right after I write it. Sometimes I'll push into the first 30 or 40 pages and just leave it alone. But ultimately, I come back to it just to make sure the building blocks of the story are solid.
So what for you is your worst distraction from getting your work done?
Oh, I have no distractions. I write for a living. Sometimes I'll practice, you know, like if I have music or song I'm working on or series of practice things that I'm trying to get together, I'll distract myself by practicing. But, you know, I'm a single father. I take my son to school, and I get up early. I get up at 4:30. And then I go to the gym sometimes, like 3 or 4 times a week. And then I come home and fix my kid something to eat. I write a little bit and fix him something to eat and get him out the door if he's with me. And then I come back and I just hit it until I get sleepy, and I take a nap, a little nap, and then I get up and hit it again, and then the phone starts ringing, and then, you know, if I'm lucky, I have a little time to practice or work on some music, and then before you know it, the day's done.
That's pretty disciplined. Are there habits that you would encourage other writers or new writers especially to pick up to help them stick to it?
Well, you know, music teaches you the habit of discipline, because if you don't practice, you just don't get any better. If you don't work at it, it leaves you. After a while, you just get used to the pace of it, and it becomes normal. I mean, for new writers or young writers or writers who are new to writing, the trick really is to rewrite. I rewrite everything, even letters, you know.
For songs, too?
Oh, yeah, I rewrite songs, too. I mean, sometimes, you know, music will come and you just don't touch it, but you don't really have to rewrite music that much, because if it's not really happening, it's not going to make it to the end, to the last bar anyway. You know, everything has to be connected in everything, in any kind of story you're telling, music or literature. Everything must be connected.
So you're writing about a real man here, James Brown, somebody that, you know, people have opinions of. They love him. They know him. They know of him. So how much research do you have to do when you're writing your book? Are you doing it throughout?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the writing is easy. It's the research that's hard. I mean, writing for me is not hard. But you can't fire your gun unless you load it up. You know, it's like one of those old Civil War muskets. You have to pack it with powder, and you have to really throw a lot of powder in it before you can stick a grape ball in there and expect it to fire. And if it's wet, or, you know, if the gun is old, it might not go anyway. So it's all about the research. James Brown, I must have interviewed, maybe 100 people, a lot of people. And most of them weren't even worth it. You know, you get nothing. And sometimes you get what you want in 10 seconds you're walking out the door, they say the thing that you thought they would. You know what really happened. So then it's just about getting someone to tell you the truth about it, which in the case of James Brown was extremely difficult.
Why do you think so challenging for him in particular?
Well, James Brown didn't want to be known, first of all. You know, he didn't want anyone. He had everyone in compartments, you know. managers, band, white, black, everybody was, so he moved around in a lot of different circles. And also he just had a lot of fear and paranoia, a lot of, he was a Southerner, he had a lot of the complexities of Southern people. And then, you know, Southern people generally like try to be real proper. They could be losing everything and they'll still serve you, you know, Coca-Cola on a little, one of those little floater things, whatever, those placemats, and, you know, everything's hunky-dory and all that, you know. So he had a lot of complexity and he didn't want people to know about that.
What for you is the best environment for writing?
I don't need to be anywhere. You know, I can't write like, you know, looking at the harbor and all that. I can't do that. I mean, the magic is on the page. I can't look out into the water and the birds are tweeting. I don't need any of that stuff. Just get to work, hit it, you know, count it off. Let's go. It doesn't matter where it is. I can write anywhere. I was writing for a long time in Holiday Inn Express, you know, just because I hated it. The smell of the carpet, people, and, you know, I just hated it. So it made me really just work hard to get it done. I wrote a whole book in a Holiday Inn Express.
Are there other books or other tools that you'd recommend for other writers to learn about writing or to help them hone their craft?
Well, I mean, for beginning writers, Bird by Bird, I can't remember the author's name.
Yeah,
Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird. For writers who are aiming for the high cotton, probably E.M. Forrester's Aspects of a Novel. It's a good book to read. And the other thing is just to read good, simple stories, you know, simple, really simple stories, not people who are like, you know, taking 10 pages to describe a leaf and all that kind of stuff. It's like hearing Sinatra sing. I mean, Sinatra just sang the melody, you know. Boom, ba, do, do, that. Or you can go see one of these jazz guys who, you know, you start playing at 7 and 3 hours pass and you look at your watch and it's 7:15, you know? I mean, what the hell? I mean, keep it simple.
What do you think the most common mistake is that new writers make and maybe that you made as a young writer?
Thinking your work is really good and making people read your work. I never ask people to read my work. When I was married, I asked my ex-wife to read my work. Maybe that's why I'm not married anymore. poor woman. I think writers who believe they have something to say are often mistaken.
Then why write?
Well, for me, you know, writing chooses you. You don't choose to write. And secondly, I don't know what else to do. I don't want to travel around, you know, the world as a saxophone player at my age. I just don't like to travel that much anymore. And I don't want to play someone else's music all the time and, you know, do the sound checks and travel with people you don't like, and this one's smoking reefer, that one's getting drunk, this one needs money. I mean, I don't know why I write. I like to write, and I try to write stuff that I would read. I try to write books that I personally would read that I think are interesting.
How many times were you rejected before you got published?
Oh, many times. I don't even remember. I mean, The Color of Water was rejected by several publishers. You know, shall I name them? I shall not. My agent wouldn't even represent me at first because she just didn't think I was good enough, you know. But I came back at her with more, and, you know, she's always to come back if you got something else. I was traveling with Michael Jackson in 1984, during the 1984 Victory Tour. That's when he was really big. I got a big book offer to do a book about him, and I turned it down.
Why?
I don't like them kinds of books. You know, he did this, he did that, he farted, you know, his dog crept on the rug. I mean, I'm not interested in that kind of nonsense. I thought he was a very nice guy, you know. Lived in a very, you know, it was a very complex situation, and I just ain't that kind of guy.
What is the best piece of advice that you ever got about writing?
I got it from Kurt Vonnegut. Now, I'm not a name-dropping kind of guy, but I did a reading with him one time, and this lady raised her hand, she said, you know, you people, you writers, you should be speaking out against the Iraq war. You need to say something and do something. And Kurt Vonnegut said, Miss, we don't have the power you think we have. If people aren't reading the books, what do you expect us to do? I thought that was really pretty appropriate.
What would your fantasy job be if you weren't a writer?
Oh, I'm living my fantasy. I mean, you know, I'd like to get an old Volvo and fix it up again like I did one time. You know, while I still have the strength to get under it and get those old stuff, those old nuts and bolts loose, I have a nice life. You know, I have kids and I teach in my church in Brooklyn twice a week. I teach music to kids, and you know, it's a nice life. I mean, traveling around hawking my books is not a whole lot of fun all the time, but I have my dream job.
James McBride, thank you very much for speaking with us.
All right, thank you for having me. Delighted.
Best-selling memoirist and National Book Award winner James McBride, author most recently of Kill Him and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. The 10-Minute Writers Workshop airs every other Thursday here on Word of Mouth, but it is also a podcast. You can subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. Mother's Day is coming up this weekend, and while many of us love and appreciate our mothers dearly, knowing how to show it or what to say can still be difficult, especially for high school students. So before we end the show today, we wanted to play a short piece by producers A and Vaughn from City High School, who asked their peers to share what they love about their moms.
Okay, what do you love about your mother?
Well, I don't even know where to start. She's just awesome. I mean, like, I'm able to talk to her about anything, and you know, she hears me out, and no matter what it might be, like, she's always, you know, there. And she doesn't really care what it is that I've done, as long as I'm straight up about it. She, you know, she takes care of me. So that's why I love my mama.
She's my best friend. She's always been there for me. Even though we had our tough times, I learned the best from her.
I love that she makes food every night because I can't cook very well.
How nice she is, and how silly she gets. And it's like all the time she's silly, and then, you know, I poke fun at her, like, oh, you're so silly, and then she, like, makes this face, she's like, really? Did I just be silly? I didn't mean to.
I love about my mama that she's my mom. I mean, I've known her my whole life, and she's always been there for me and supported me, and in pretty much everything that I've ever wanted to pursue, and she's always been really great to me. She, like, got me into punk rock when I was a little kid, and she, you know, just showed me so much, and she's all, like, cool and roller derby and, like, buff and stuff. It's sweet.
I love the fact that she loves me unconditionally, and she supports me in everything.
I don't think she knows how to be mean to people.
I just love that she's, like, really, really, really crazy supportive of, like, anything anyone wants to do.
What I love about my mother is that she is very nice, even when the other people around her aren't very nice.
She's my mom, and because she's great, and she's nice, and she's funny, and she helps everybody, and she's so cute.
I actually love my mom because she forces me to do stuff that I don't want to do.
I love everything about my mom.
Okay, that's your sweet, not meant to be finger waggy reminder that Mother's Day is coming up this Sunday. We thank you for your listening time today. There's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can also listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. And do us a favor, if you like the podcast, pass it on to others. Rate it on iTunes. That'll help others find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.